From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, despite the overwhelming evidence that Joe Biden won the presidential election, President Trump and his supporters are looking for ways to overthrow the results, and how militia groups in Texas are standing by and ready to act to keep Trump in power.
They feel it's their patriotic duty to, if President Trump calls them to arms, that they would take up arms.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. President Trump continues to tweet that he won the November 3rd presidential election, but his legal team has not presented evidence in court or in public that the election was actually rigged or otherwise unfair. If the law is followed, we should expect that Joseph Biden will be inaugurated on January 20th as the 46th president of the United States. If you can't wait until then, here are other dates to watch in the process. December 8th is the safe harbor deadline when each state, 6 days in advance of the Electoral College meeting, must certify its votes. Members of the Electoral College will meet and vote on December 14th. January 6th is the joint session of Congress, where those final votes are presented and confirmed. But how likely is it that Donald Trump is somehow going to break this chain of events? Dallas lawyer and SMU adjunct law professor Eric Cedillo says, based on lawsuits filed by Trump, he is losing that fight.
I think we're seeing a big difference in terms of what they're stating publicly, them being the campaign, and what they're actually introducing into court. Big difference in terms of what it is you have to show and prove in a court of law. And I just don't think there's any evidence or support that would change the election or change what it is they're purporting to make of some of these lawsuits. So unfortunately for the campaign, I don't think there's anything there that is going to be enough to, of course, change the number of ballots that could be disallowed to have any changes to the actual election results themselves. Even getting rid of a few hundred ballots isn't going to change things. But unfortunately for the campaign, I don't see that these lawsuits are making much of a dent. And, of course, many of them are being tossed out of hand. So it's going to be a tough road to hoe to make any changes to actually disallow these ballots.
Frequently you hear the expression extraordinary claims demands extraordinary evidence. Is that also something that you would have in a courtroom if you're going to make extraordinary claims about Hugo Chavez trying to hack our elections? Do you have to present actual evidence to back that up?
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt if you're alleging fraud, and I think in most of these cases, as you may have seen, some of these got tossed because there were, actual claims of fraud, but when you attempt to present the evidence in accordance, it just isn't there. I think some of the lawyers were asked, well, are you contending that there's any fraud, asked by the judge, and they said no. Then, of course, that changes everything and changes it to a new level. To disallow a ballot, I mean, it's a fundamental right. It's very hard to do to get those things thrown out. So if something like that were true and they were true to have some evidence to support it, I'm sure this would have already been introduced in some of these cases. We're not seeing it. We're just kind of hearing about it, on the airwaves, on social media. But if they're not offering it in, which of course you'd be subject to additional sanctions by the court if it wasn't true or honest or something to that effect. So it's a situation where they probably don't exist or they don't have evidence to support it, and they're just kind of maintaining it, over the airwaves.
Sworn signed affidavits by people who say they witnessed some sort of suspicious behavior, and that's being presented as evidence as fraud. I mean, how much weight does that have?
Yeah, again, it depends specifically on what it is they're maintaining. I think a couple of them, the judges maintain that this is just basically hearsay. It's no first-party knowledge. It's what I heard or what I thought. And contentions or belief, if they can be explained away, the other side is, of course, going to have the opportunity to explain some of these situations away. If someone thinks that a ballot is being destroyed, and then someone else says, no, those weren't actual ballots, they were XYZ, so those, there may be video support for it, but it's actually not what it is it purports it to be, then the judge takes that into consideration. So it's a situation where you can have people swearing to things, but if they don't meet the level of the criteria of direct evidence or support for it, a judge takes that into consideration. He listens to the testimony. He talks to the people kind of coming in and testifying to what it is they're testifying to, and that's what he takes into consideration.
Does it seem that what we're looking at is a probing of our legal system, looking for some sort of weakness, some sort of judge who may be a Trump zealot who would go along with this?
I know it's possible. It's possible that I think more than anything else, they're kind of a scatter shooting. They're shooting in a number of ways in a number of different lawsuits. But again, none of them, and I think they realize this, none of them will have the practical effect of changing the results. If that is what their motivation is, to actually change the election results in some way, they've got so many states that they're behind in that that even if they were to get what they're asking for, it's not going to change the result. So unfortunately for the campaign itself, I just don't think from a legal perspective this isn't going to change. Now, does it support a narrative that they're trying to promulgate and get supporters to maintain that they have a shot or a chance? I think that's the purpose of what it is they're doing. But from a legal standpoint, it just isn't going to work.
We've heard from Rudy Giuliani, Trump's attorney, that tens of thousands of ballots should be tossed out from certain counties because of the number of absentee ballots that were used in that county, simply because of that. And he says this is highly irregular and anyone could use these ballots. It could be Mickey Mouse, we hear him say frequently. But just the idea of tossing out tens of thousands of ballots from a certain location simply because it seems suspect to one person, why is that even an argument? Is that really an argument?
Well, it's probably not one that any judge is going to buy. Of course, you need support, hard evidence to support, the casting out of ballots or the disallowance of ballots. And in this context, you gotta realize that just because even if something were to be wrong with the way or the process or deviated from the process in some way, it doesn't mean that those voters didn't rely on that information. So, for example, the ballots that were received in Pennsylvania after the, election day, their Supreme Court maintained that could be allowed to happen for 3 days after. Those people relied on that information. And if the United States Supreme Court somehow maintained that that shouldn't have happened, it shouldn't have been that way, they still, the casting out of tens of thousands of ballots or thousands of ballots based on that is going to be very hard to do, because that is a fundamental right to vote. If someone relies on what the government is telling them, then chances are those ballots are not going to be cast away. So you can make them maintain or assert that there was a deviation from their election code, but it doesn't necessarily mean that those ballots are going to be cast out.
This all comes down to assigning the electoral votes from states. That comes down to legislatures. Can you talk about if these lawsuits are really just trying to appeal to those lawmakers, overturning the results of the state's popular vote to assign those electoral votes to the other candidate, Donald Trump? Could that happen?
Yeah, what you have is different election codes. You have different laws in every state. Some states, they take the process of the legislature completely out of it. They wouldn't have any ability to do anything like that. In some states, of course, the United States Supreme Court recently maintained that state legislatures can, of course, determine who the electors are, and that's always been the process. You can determine how you're going to figure out who the electors are. And most of our states, and 48 of them, we maintain the popular vote is the party that is allowed to present their electors. So it's a situation where that is possible. But I believe that the Constitution and the U.S. Code would maintain that those changes would have to occur before the election day. So before November 3rd, they should have made those modifications if they were going to do it. So if they try to do it after the fact and present their own electors, I just don't think that would be constitutional and violative of U.S. Code. So I don't think it's possible for that to happen. That is the question about whether or not it's possible, whether or not there's a willingness for legislatures to do that. Again, I think we're hearing from a number of legislatures that they wouldn't do that they would subvert the will of the people in terms of those votes. So I don't think that's going to happen, but that's a situation that the campaign may be trying to strategize around.
Eric Cedillo is a Dallas lawyer and a professor of law at SMU. The National Task Force on Election Crises is calling on the General Services Administration to ascertain that Joe Biden is the president-elect. Doing so will give Biden's transition team funding, office space, and security briefings. Tammy Patrick is a member of the task force and the elections senior advisor at the Democracy Fund. She and others have been planning for this rough transition of presidential power.
The Election Crisis Task Force came together, started a little more than a year ago now, to really contemplate what sort of issues or concerns might arise in the 2020 election. So it is comprised of former election officials such as myself, of academic scholars of constitutional law, stakeholders in the various nonprofit world, to really kind of sit down, do some doomsday scenario planning, plan out the sort of things that might arise in a presidential election, and then what some of the best strategies might be in those situations to combat and confront any sort of mis or disinformation to make sure that that the election went off successfully.
What does doomsday look like?
Doomsday surfaces in a variety of ways, but what we are seeing, and I think it's really disheartening, that in these dwindling days of this presidency, in the midst of that global pandemic that is now surging again rather than abating, that we have an outgoing president that's using his time to attack our democratic norms and dismantle government agencies to really try and subvert the will of the people in a way.
So could doomsday be Donald Trump figures out a way to remain in office, obviously an illegitimate president, still in executive control of the United States government, and we basically never have another fair election again?
That would certainly be not only a catastrophe and a doomsday, but I also think that that's not what's going to happen. But I will say that in almost 20 years of working in elections, I've never witnessed this type of behavior that we're seeing now. So the attempt to negate votes from entire cities, like we saw in Michigan, or entire counties, like was being proposed in Georgia, or really to subvert the will of the people and the various state laws all across the country. So we know that while concession isn't necessary, it's really symbolic of a civil and peaceful transition, and that these constant unfounded false claims and frivolous lawsuits really do undermine the integrity of our elections and what people believe and have confidence in. But it will do nothing to delay the inevitable. The current presidential term is up in January. The people have spoken. The ballots have been counted, recounted, and audited. And now is really the time for other elected officials to speak up as well, because those who I think are sitting idly by and allowing this false narrative to happen are just as culpable.
What's the role of the media, journalism, in this time? I'm seeing more aggressive terminology being used to talk about what's happening right now through news networks saying this is an attempted coup. This is an attempt to throw away our democracy. This is an authoritarian power grab. I mean, this is that language appropriate, and is it helpful?
So I think that the media has done a great job of really covering the election and informing the electorate. In this moment, and I've often said when I talk to media folks that, words are so important and words really do matter. In this moment, is this hyperbole to refer to this type of action that's being taken? Is that an accurate assessment? And it very well may be. Part of the challenge I think that the media faces, in the same way that election officials faced doing their job in 2020, is that for months, if not years, this administration has sought to undermine and discredit the role of the media, the messages and the facts that the media are providing to our nation and our electorate. And so in this moment, I think it's very important that the right information, the correct information, and the facts come out, and that we tend to, in this moment, not necessarily need to give weight to an equal time to lies and mis and disinformation that needs to be labeled as such, and make sure that we're calling out the facts, because the facts truly do matter.
So Do we call it a coup? Do we call it an authoritative power grab?
I don't know if I'm comfortable making that decision. That's up for the editors, right? that put the headlines on it. And also, I have heard some say we don't know quite what to call it because we don't know how it will play out. But in this moment, it seems that if the definition is an individual seeking power or to maintain power, subverting the will of the people and channeling some ulterior way that's counterintuitive to our constitutional paths as a way to maintain power, then that would be a pretty accurate assessment.
Tammy Patrick is a member of the National Task Force on Election Crises and the Election Senior Advisor at the Democracy Fund. What happens if President Trump exhausts his legal options to remain in power, but he resorts to brute force? Or if well-armed, devoted followers of Trump decide to take action on their own? Reuters correspondent Brad Brooks reports that some Trump supporters in Texas say they're willing to take up arms against the American government the minute that Trump gives the order.
Myself and two of the colleagues, we spent the better part of a week speaking with about 50 Trump supporters across the country. I'm based in West Texas myself, so I focused on a few small towns in Hockley County. And what we found is that really ordinary, average people are being driven to extremes. In my case, I focused on Trump supporters in the small town of Sundown in Hockley County and spoke with the mayor, spoke with, you know, some leading small town businessmen, real pillars of the community type of folks, really good people. And they are so concerned about the election and about allegations of fraud that they're being driven to the extreme of they feel it's their patriotic duty to, if President Trump calls them to arms, that they would take up arms.
What does that mean to take up arms? You're going to get your weapons and do what?
Well, nobody I spoke with and nobody either of my colleagues spoke with is telling us that they're going to be carrying out some sort of offensive or anything like that. In fact, the people that I spoke with in Sundown, Texas are really just talking about, essentially defense. They formed this South Plains Patriots group well before the election, on July 3rd, actually. And they have a very small armed reactionary group is what they call it. And that's what it is to react against any sort of violence being carried out against them during any sort of Trump rallies or any sort of political gathering. These are not extremists in the sense of militia, white nationalist extremists or anything like that. These are ordinary average people who have grown so concerned about the political environment in the United States that they think it's really necessary to get organized and to have to be politically organized, to be civically organized, and to have a small group within this larger South Plains Patriot group that could act to defend the group as a whole. Nobody offered any guesses in terms of, what might happen. Let me reinforce it. These are not people who are planning on going out and storming, the state capitol or vote counting places or anything like that. When I posed various scenarios with them in terms of, okay, let's imagine that, it's January 20th, Joe Biden takes office, President Trump refuses to leave, we worked through various scenarios and, on the extreme end, like we said in the story, or like one of the sources said in the story, if it's clear to them that there was fraud, or I should say, if President Trump continues to say that there's fraud, and if he says that he cannot, that the courts are against him, and if he says, I need your help. I need patriotic armed Americans to stand up and fight for me. They would. I mean, and that's, you know, nobody ventured a guess, and you know, as to what that actually would look like.
Where do these people get most of their information from?
One of the really revealing things to me in reporting this out was that every single person I spoke with, and I just spoke with Trump supporters, every single person I spoke with said that they had stopped watching Fox News since the election. Specifically, they mentioned Fox News calling Arizona for Biden, you know, pretty early, you know, as the first network to do so. And now they all get their news from Newsmax, from OANN. They've all abandoned Twitter, Facebook, and have moved over to social media platforms like Parler, which are aimed at geared for, you know, the much more conservative voices.
And they feel like they're receiving the truth.
They do. They do. And I was very, you know, with everyone I spoke with, and especially the people I spoke with in Sundown, I spent quite a bit of time with some of them. You know, I told them where I was coming from. You know, I said, look, I just don't see anything that points to these, that is bolstering the president's allegations here. And, you know, just pointed to the lawsuits that, you know, some of them are filed directly by the Trump team, some of them by supporters, and they've just really not gotten that much traction. And we just agreed to disagree, I guess. It's for, as a journalist, it's extremely scary for me to really understand how Americans cannot agree on the truth. And I know that's old hat for people that have been here, but I've been out of the United States for the last 15 years. I was in Latin America working, and I just didn't realize how fundamentally eroded people's trust in media and in facts really is.
And the results of that is kind of dangerous.
Yeah, the results of that are potentially explosive. I mean, obviously, if Americans cannot agree on some really basic truths, then we're going to have a lot of clashes ahead of us.
Brad Brooks is a correspondent for the Reuters news agency. He is stationed in Lubbock. What happens after losing an election? The executive branch refuses to concede and leave office. As always, there's a Texas governor in history for that. In this case, it's Edmund J. Davis. Historian Carl Moynihan wrote a biography of Governor Davis.
Well, Governor Davis was the Republican governor who was elected in the election of 1869. He took office in 1870. He was a staunch unionist, and rather than supporting the Confederacy, he ultimately left the state, joined the Union Army, and became a brigadier general in the Union Army. First of all, he formed the 1st Texas Cavalry U.S., but then went on to a higher command. He was I'm not sure what you'd call him.
I've heard the word scallywag, is it?
He is a traditional scallywag, but he just doesn't fit the traditional scallywag is a fellow who came in with his usually someone who had not had political power beforehand, who came in and seized political power under the Congressional Reconstruction. He was hardly that. I mean, he was a fairly prominent politician prior to the Civil War. In fact, he was a state district judge down in the Corpus Christi, Brownsville district. He was very honorable. He held to his ideology. He came in after the Civil War, accepted black suffrage, and then was pretty much committed after that to protecting African Americans in their basic civil rights against violence and that sort of thing. So, he doesn't in fact live up to the reputation that the Democrats tarred him with in the post Civil War era.
But he did run for re-election in December of 1872.
We usually associate him with trying to hold on to his office after the war illegally. And that's not quite the story. It's a really much more complicated story than most people have always thought about it as. The fact is, the real crux of the story
is Sheriff A.B. Hall down in Houston, and he lost his election. He was a Republican who lost his election. And what happens is he gets a fellow by the name of Rodriguez to vote twice in the election, and then he hires two prominent lawyers, Republican lawyers. One of them is former Governor A.J. Hamilton, and they go to the Texas Supreme Court and plead that he couldn't be convicted of illegally voting because the election itself was illegal. And that has to do with the way the Constitution was written. And the Texas Supreme Court rules that he's right, that the election, that the legislature changed it unconstitutionally. And so the election was, in fact, illegal. Well, that's where Davis gets involved at this point, because Davis is the governor. He's a former lawyer. He's a former law.
So basically, it's a hot mess.
And then
he loses this election, though, still, right?
He clearly loses it. And he knows he loses it, and he says he loses it. I mean, he said he has no intention of staying in office beyond when his term of office ends. Well, all he's really contending is that he should hold office not just in January when the legislature meets, but he should hold it all the way until March of 1874. And then what happens is the Democrats essentially do two things. And this is why the Hall thing becomes so, I guess, comparable to today, is they first of all rule that the court should not have any say in an election that's already been held. That everyone agreed to the conditions of the election, no one complained about it beforehand, and as a result of that, the court needs to be ignored, and they do. And they also essentially then get fearful that Davis holding on for three more months might create some problems. And so essentially what happens in January is the legislature meets and goes ahead and inaugurates Richard Koch, who had defeated Davis back in the previous year. And that's where it becomes complicated, because Davis says, no, you can't. I hold office till March. Well, the legislature goes ahead and meets. Governor brings together some components of the state militia, not much of them really supporting him at this point, but there are a few black militia units that are supporting him. They occupy the first floor of the Capitol. The legislature is on the second floor. They can't get through the first floor, so they put a ladder so they can go through the window to the legislative chambers on the second floor. And so Davis basically says, well, you know, what chance do I have? These guys outnumber me. The only way I could possibly react to this is to essentially foment a race war. And he says, I'm not going to do that. And so he goes to the mansion. He and his wife load up the things. But
Davis locks the governor's office and takes the key with him?
Theoretically. Actually, he doesn't do that. That's James Newcomb, who was Secretary of State. And he locks up the executive offices when they leave. And so they have to break into the door.
So the Democrats need an axe to chop down the door.
Yeah. but it's as you can see, it's not simply comparable to what's going on today, although there are elements of it.
Carl Moneyhan is a specialist in the history of the American Civil War and the South. Among his books is Edmund J. Davis of Texas, Civil War General, Republican Leader, Reconstruction Governor. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.